Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And a very interesting book comes my way. It's called The Continuum Concept by author Gene Liedloff, L-I-E-D-L-O-F-F, who we're going to be having on air in just a second here. Gene Liedloff wrote a book about her travels through South America. And she went through South America and discovered quite a few things that she wants to bring to our attention, especially about, or I find the most intriguing part of this, the part about what it is to be a child connected to a parent. But let's hear from Gene first. Gene, are you on air with us? Real question for you is, how were you when you were a baby? How did your mother treat you? How were you with your family? Were you considered a nuisance? Were you a welcome? Were you an invitation? Did they celebrate you? Was it a party? Did they want to have you around? Did they keep you around? Did they keep contact with you? Was there physical contact between you and your mom and your dad? You know, was there? Was there? And so these are some of the questions that I find fascinating, because especially there's a couple of questions nowadays about how long a child should be kept connected to its parents. And we're going to start this off by introducing an ex-WBAI producer herself, Gene Liedloff, who a few years ago had her stint here on WBAI. Gene, welcome to WBAI.
Oh, thank you, Armand. Hello.
Hello there. So could you tell us a little bit about your experience going, you know, and what brought you to the continuum concept?
Well, I mean, I actually, on my first trip abroad, I was invited when I got to Florence by some Italians who were going to the South American jungle to look for for diamonds. And, well, oddly enough, I was attracted to the word jungle, not diamonds. But when I got to the jungle, I became more and more fascinated with the ways of the Indians, because, just to jump ahead a bit, I actually ended up making 5 expeditions. I spent a total of 2.5 years in the jungle with these Indians who are culturally Stone Age. I mean, they were a bit like we were when we were in the Stone Age.
Of South America was that in?
Well, it was the southern part of Venezuela in the Orinoco River Basin, just above the Amazon. But it's just one big jungle. I mean, Amazon, Orinoco, whatever, but it's just one big jungle with rivers in it. And these people, a few of the older men had seen a Spanish explorer in the 1930s, but none of the other ones had ever seen anybody who wasn't an Indian. So I was really in an amazing situation. It was quite amazing to find myself there and to live in this world. And, of course, what had to do without language, I was just able to sort of, manage. They didn't speak Spanish or anything. Each tribe spoke its own pre-Columbian language. I was always asking them, what's the word for this and what's the word for that? So I kind of meet Tarzan, Eugene, my way around a bit and waved my arms around, to communicate. But what I found was that these people are having a much better time with our common human nature than we are. And, I mean, I didn't really sort of notice it at first, because first I was looking at, how exotic everything was, but I realized that they're just having a better time. And, gradually I began to see what was responsible for these, greater, well-being issues, for them. What were we doing wrong? What could we, I guess I became a reverse missionary. I was sort of bringing back the good news, from them to us rather than the other way around.
Because when you got there, you observed that people were a lot more peaceful, a lot more relaxed, a lot more comfortable,
in tune with themselves. Interesting. Two things that bespoke their well-being that I noticed particularly. One was the frequency of laughter. When you were in their little, sort of villages or settlements, there was, you'd hear little sort of blossoms of laughter going on different times during the day and night. That was quite frequent. And then the other thing was I noticed that their muscle tone was just much more relaxed. I mean, most of us, I, for example, have a lot of tension around my neck and shoulders. I think a lot of us do, and some have in the middle of their back, some of them. A lot of us have a kind of jaw tension, you know what I mean, Armand?
Sure,
we have a kind of, like a permanent frown or a permanent smile, which shows tension. But they're just kind of relaxed, like a clear sky, and every once in a while a cloud would come and they'd express their emotions. But they were just in a generally relaxed body tone, muscle tone.
So you asked yourself naturally, look at these folks. They seem to be having a good time. What is it that makes them so relaxed? And I think you're saying it is living closer to their natural evolutionary self, less fettered by a lot of the modern society and the stuff that we've got, lets them be more relaxed. But
Well, relaxed isn't the word that I choose, because, they're not just sort of ragdolls. but they're just easier, maybe. They feel at home in their own skins, and they're much more, they don't have the touch taboos that we have, if especially like if two men happen to touch, bump into each other, hoping that they won't be mistaken for gay or something, there are less touch taboos among the sort of theatrical people but a lot of people, they don't hug and they barely touch. And I think we have a great sort of starvation for it because, what I observed especially about that seemed to be, after watching them a while to try to figure out what it was that they're doing right that we're doing wrong, the thing that was most critical, I think, was the fact that from birth they hold their babies. There's no reason for a baby to cry there. I almost never heard a baby cry. I never heard one scream, really scream. The most I would ever hear would be a little that kind of little thing, but very rarely. And I realized that what they're doing is going along with human nature, and what I came to describe as the innate expectations of our species based upon our experience during the time that we were evolving, and therefore what we adapted to as a species. Now, what we adapted to, I'm now saying, is what we expect. Does that make sense?
I don't exactly understand what we expect.
Well, what I'm saying is that, as for the last hundreds of thousands of years, during the time we evolved into Homo sapiens, into human beings, we have always been held close to the body of some living person, usually the mother, but sometimes the father, sometimes an elder sibling or just another person. But we haven't been left, a baby put down somewhere. Because, of course, they could have been eaten or, fall into some kind of harm. So, what I'm saying is that a baby has an innate expectation that it will be held. And if it is not held and slept with and, always in contact with it, with another body, it cries. And we don't need a dictionary to know what the crying means. We don't think, isn't that cute? It's happy. We know that it's a sign of distress. And we have corresponding innate responses, which is to say, we have a desire, even if it's not our own baby, it's a kind of a, even if it isn't even our own species of baby. If you hear a kitten you know, mewing in distress, or a little animal, you know, crying. Yeah. We have this response that we want to comfort it. We want, and we know how to do it. We know how to pick up our babies and hold them, and we know that the babies will stop crying, because in fact they do stop crying.
Well, and, Jean, wait a minute now. Yeah. This is quite. So now the basis of what you're saying is some kind of society that seems a lot saner than the rest of us.
Yeah.
You know, and I know these are my words and not yours.
Yeah.
They have at the basis of that something about the child rearing. And it's like each child who is part of that, those tribes down in South America, is held and stays close to its mother and close to its father in the way that they were meant to be.
Yeah.
Because they don't get put down, because it's kind of nature not to put your baby down because a bird might come and pick it up and take it away. So
or a jaguar or a crocodile,
right. So what happens instead is I'm just thinking about how many of us yearn to be touched, to be held, to be,
yeah.
and I think, jumping ahead of it, what you're saying is, you know, Armand, part of what happens down there is people don't have these yearnings because they have a different kind of parenting right from the beginning.
Right, yeah.
And so this antagonism isn't there, this restlessness isn't there. So
I could barely hear you.
Oh, you could barely hear me, okay. So this restlessness is not there, you know, this general...
Okay, let's just leave the restlessness and go to the extremes of this restlessness.
Sure.
Talk about Columbine. Talk about those two boys. Who just decided together they were going to go massacre everybody in the library or whatever. Okay. after that, it was interesting. Some public radio reporter decided to do a kind of survey in America, and I guess they were talking to high school kids because that's what the Columbine thing was. And to see, they interviewed just at random, a typical kind of cross-section of American high school kids. And they said, they asked these kids, do you personally know anybody among your schoolmates or friends or neighbors who you think might be capable of this kind of rage, this, you know, like Klebold and Harris did at Columbine in Colorado, of just going out and just killing everybody out of rage. And 40% of them, which is huge when you think about it, Armand, 40% of them said, yes, I know someone, you know, so-and-so, who has that level, you can feel it, of rage in him. Well, I mean, this is an amazing thing, because I think that the 40% who said yes were maybe a little bit more observant. But I think that if you look at it, the way we are brought up, we have a kind of seething anger under the surface most of the time, which makes us, even if we don't always, you know, well, we certainly don't go out murdering people all the time, but an awful lot of people who say, oh, gosh, I'd like to kill for an idea, or a feeling, a lot of it comes out in competitive sports or other forms of competitiveness. There's a kind of anger. You think, well, what's the purpose of having this anger, this rage in us? Well, it's not part of our nature. I feel that it's part of the response to our species being treated inappropriately. It's from birth where we're taken out of the womb and we're given a whack on the bottom to make us cry, and everybody says, whoopee, you know, the baby's crying, therefore it's breathing, therefore it's alive, and then they put it in a box, you know, put some lifeless cloth on it, and, you know, the baby cries and they're all fine. Well, the point is that we have been for these hundreds of thousands of years since our, you know, I mean, as we turned into human beings through evolution, our experience has been that we were then held to the mother's bosom, nursed, And the first thing that we drank from the bosom was something called colostrum, which gave us all kinds of wonderful immunities even before the milk came through. But then there was always the experience that the baby had from being inside the womb to being outside the same body, sensing the same heartbeat, or a heartbeat, and having the temperature of a body, and professors at Case Western Reserve University did an experiment to show that the baby, very minutes after birth, is looking for the mother's eyes, and that the mother is looking to look eye to eye into the baby's eyes on the same level. You know, in other words, the mother sort of picks the baby up so that they can look into each other's eyes.
Now, let's just take this a moment, a little further. People who are listening to this, many of them are going to remember whether they were close to their parents or not, physically close. Many people I know were never held by their mothers. They will talk about it. They were bottle-fed, never held. I remember once, at one point, La Leche League made mention of your work, and they kind of said, you know, this is all part of this. It's all part of being held and being nurtured. You say in your book, The Continuum Concept, the author's name, Jean Liedloff, Liedloff, Jean says, keep holding on to that baby. Don't put that baby down. Don't let that baby go. And take it to bed with you and keep it until it's ready to go. Is that right, Jean?
Yeah, but, I mean, let's just say we're ready to go. I mean,
I know a guy, 46, who still hasn't left.
Well, would his mother look like King Kong?
Right, for sure.
Well, okay. No, but, I mean, really and truly, at the age of 46, 56, 66, and so
it might be time.
We are still craving this experience, because what I'm saying, what I'm also proposing, is that we have as part of our species, a developmental sequence, a series of experiences upon which we develop optimally, appropriately as Homo sapiens. And if we miss these steps, like being held and in close, I mean, not just close, but really up against the body of another person, we keep waiting for it and wanting it on through life, and whether you're 46 or whatever. If it's missing, you don't simply outgrow the need. What you do is you live with it, and it sort of keeps gnawing at you inside in one way or in another, and you seek that kind of baby position very often. You know, people very often try to get mothered by their husbands or by their wives, typically. Sometimes they try to get as a sort of infantile position, even with their children. They try to get, jockey for this position with the corporation, with the church, with the state. When in fact, the Indians that I lived with really grow up comfortably. They've had all they need. Well, they sleep in hammocks, so, there's no way you can not be sleeping in contact with someone you're sharing a hammock with because of the nature of the hammock. But that's beside the point. The thing is that they're always in physical contact. When they're walking around, the baby is always being held by somebody. Very often it's somebody else, not the mother. But they just take it to the mother to be nursed. But it's very often children are carrying around babies, and it's their favorite thing to do. They love taking care of babies. They love holding them, carrying them around while they're doing something else, while they're playing. I mean, we kind of sort of recognize this strong maternal instinct in children, and we kind of pawn it off on giving them dolls. I mean, the favorite toys of children, especially little girls, are baby dolls. And we kind of recognize that without actually acknowledging that it's their nature to be taking care of real babies. And they're very good at it. The Indians that I live with trusted really quite small children to take care of babies, knowing, that they have a natural talent for it. And by the time they have their first babies, of course, they've been doing it all their lives.
On the negative side, you know, you could think of people who are dying to be held in some way. And some of the theoreticians have looked at this kind of starvation for proper nurturing as resulting in criminal behavior, such as drug addiction. In effect, you know, the drugs become the mother holding you. And then someone even took it further as a development, and they said criminal behavior is an attempt to put yourself in a position of a child by getting yourself thrown into a jail where you have no choices anymore and you're being held, in effect.
Yeah, that sounds like the kind of thing, I mean, I'm certainly not saying, you know, that it's the root of all criminal behavior, but a great deal of it, because the point is that it makes one feel, the thing that's so damaging about it, Armand, really, is the fact that, you know, say, okay, I'm a baby and I'm crying and all my skin is craving the touch and the embrace of my mother or, you know, an adult. And nobody comes over, because the fear is not because the mother is the sort of most desirable, beautiful object, the thing that I want the most. So I feel that what's wrong is that I'm not good enough. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So the awful result of this is that you feel that you're the wrong thing. And so if you're feeling anti-self, which is pretty much the result of our, not just America, but the whole of Western civilization, pretty much people feel that they're not good enough. That you could imagine when you're feeling anti-self, it's not very difficult to see why you'd feel anti-social.
Well, you know, how could you love yourself if you've never been loved? Is basically the way it becomes.
Well, I mean, you're using the word love. I'd rather
let's get off the word love. I got
it. No, love is. I mean, we're describing love. We're talking about what love is.
Well, what love is?
But just to say, oh well, you know, well, I love my children. So, you know, the point is. What I'm talking about is the components of it, what it is. Appropriate, correct human love is holding, touching, you know, welcoming. And the two words that I actually didn't think of them until after I wrote the book, but the two words that we should all feel, babies, children, and adults, we should all feel these two words, worthy and welcome. That's the way that human beings ought to feel about ourselves. And in fact, we don't. We don't. I mean, I've never felt a welcome a day in my life because I had this beautiful, brilliant mother who was an artist and who was all kinds of things, but she wasn't interested in holding me, you know.
Hmm.
And she was always, you know, kind of a hippie type, my mother, and she was she was paid maybe too much of the wrong kind of attention by her parents who adored her and so forth, but she was always, you know, kind of a rebel. So
what you discovered when you went down to South America,
yeah.
it touched off in you this kind of deprivation.
What? Sorry, I didn't hear that.
It touched off this deprivation that you feel, and it certainly made you
notice. Well, I didn't recognize it as my own for a long time.
It took quite a while.
Yeah, I mean, when I related it to, you know, my own feeling of never. I mean, I remember just always, not just as a baby, but growing up, always desperately trying to get my mother to pay attention to me. I mean, what I really wanted was for her to be proud of me, but I didn't even hope for that. I just wanted her to pay attention to me.
To, you know, hold you, in effect, to hold you in her eyes, to hold you in her heart.
Well, just to think that I was a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from being held.
Oh, that's beautifully said, Jean. Just to think I was a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. To feel, I mean, like, you know, if I came into a room to feel, to see her eyes say, oh, good, you know, that's Jean. Do you know?
To feel.
And very often, I mean, just think how many of us, you know, a bit, you know, you come into the living room or the kitchen, you see your mother, and she, oh, God, you know, that sort of rolls her eyes, and, oh, you again kind of thing. And that just goes right to the heart, to the bones of that child who defines himself or herself by the parental kind of dictum, I mean, the verdict. You feel, and it's just one's nature to feel that one's parents or the parental figures, whoever they are right. I mean, we learn from them. We're social animals, and especially we feel that they are the ones who know. And their authority, on their authority, we feel that we're not good enough because we're not good enough for them. They are the authority figures.
And then we carry that on. And how many couples we see nowadays where the husband and wife feel the same way about each other? You know, the husband walks into the morning breakfast table and the wife virtually rolls her eyes. In effect, or you turn your back to somebody you care about. And you don't have that kind of... you have a kind of, it's almost a disdain as opposed to...
It's a disdain, yeah, yeah.
As opposed to what you're saying, worthy and welcome.
Yeah.
Boy, I tell you, Jean, I really appreciate your being with us today. The name of the book is The Continuum Concept.
It's in paperback at any bookshop.
Yes,
And you can get it at Amazon and all that. Anyway, yeah.
You get it at Amazon and all over the Amazon.
And also, you might be interested to know that it's in about 27 different languages now.
You've done a good thing.
All over the world.
Jean, you've done a very good thing. The Continuum Concept, Jean Liedloff, as usual, one of the WBAI producers.
No, actually, I was an interviewer, not a producer. Somebody else was producing me.
And you did the show The Explorers.
It was called The Explorers at the time, a long time ago.
You interviewed explorers.
What?
And you became one. And you became one. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, Armand, you're a charmer, and it was a pleasure.
Thank you, Jean.
Thanks.
Bye. So Jean opens up some very, very interesting idea here about being held, about you and being held. What's it like? What's your yearning to be held like? Or are you one of these people who don't want to be felt, don't want to be touched, don't want anybody to get near you? It's possible. You know, are you somebody who rejects anybody coming close to you? Or are you somebody who is yearning to be touched? We're going to continue with this conversation when we get back from our break. This is Armand DeMille. We're going to take a short break, play you some... Hey, should we play you some nice old music or should we play you some new modern music? Would you take a vote right now? Nice old music or new modern music? Send it through the airwaves. If you want something really nice and old, I promise I could tweak you. Or something new, just in your own mind, make a vote. As soon as we do our station identification, I will respond to your wishes.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
Tahrir, Liberation. Marhaba, I'm Barbara Nimri Aziz. Tahrir is a long WBAI tradition and still strong in voices of the Arab Muslim community here and abroad. I invite you to tune in Tuesday evenings at 7 for discussions on Islam and society, justice and injustice, in-depth interviews with writers from across the world, and Fen Mashnoon, Crazy Arts, with Dean and Maysoon.
We'll be right back.
Yeah, that's the modern version. How many of you are standing up right now doing a cha-cha around your kitchen table? You know, the very first cha-cha-cha, cherry pink and apple blossom white, Prez Prado. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests that'll help you lead a more positively minded life. What happened to our children? What happened to us? Jean Liedloff, L-I-E-D-L-O-F-F, brilliant, The Continuum Project. A gift to us from Paula Jeck, by the way, my office manager and therapist here, who brought this to me and said, do this. I'm so glad you did, Paula. Continuum Project. Here's the thought. Now, here's the thought. So they look down there, and they see these Indians, and she goes down five times, Jean. Jean, who is starved for affection, the author, goes down, and she notices nobody ever puts their baby down, and the babies are laughing. And so, of course, Jean notices it and says, what's going on here? And the closer she looks, the more she writes about the Continuum Project, the more she says, you're just letting the babies go too soon. Well, there's some conflict about it, because in some people, sometimes she says, keep the baby in the bed with you, you know, with the two of you, you and your husband, you know, right up until the age of two or three, whenever, until the baby's ready to leave. Other people say, don't do that. You know, the Spock system is, no, get him out of the bed, let him cry, it's not going to hurt him. But let's take that entire thing and put it aside. Let's put it aside. Let's say, forget about the theory. What about you? What about you? What about your response to human touch? What does it feel like? You know, what is it like? Are you somebody who's going to be alone? I was looking through some papers, and twice in my life, or maybe three times, I received letters of poetry by young people. So I'm going to read you a couple I received. And I thought, I would even do this with a little background. The first one was written by a 16-year-old boy in high school. And he wrote this poem, and in this poem he said, he always wanted to explain things, but no one cared, so he drew. Sometimes he would draw, and it wasn't anything. He wanted to carve it in stone or write it in the sky. And it would be only the sky and him and the things inside him that needed saying. And it was after that he drew the picture. He kept it under his pillow and would let no one see it. And he would look at it every night and think about it. And when it was dark and his eyes were closed, he could still see it. It was all of him, and he loved it. When he started school, he brought the picture with him. Not to show anyone, but just to have it with him like a friend. It was funny about school. He sat on a square brown desk, like all the other square brown desks, and he thought it should be red. And his room was a square brown room, like all the other rooms, and it was tight and close and stiff. He hated to hold the pencil and the chalk, with his arms stiff and his feet flat on the floor, stiff, with the teacher watching and watching. The teacher came and spoke to him. She told him to wear a tie like all the other boys, and he said he didn't like them. And she said it didn't matter. After that, they drew. And he drew all yellow, and it was the way he felt about morning. And it was beautiful. And the teacher came and smiled at him and said, what's that? She said, why don't you draw something like Ken's drawing? Isn't it beautiful? After that, his mother bought him a tie. And he always drew airplanes and rocket ships like everyone else. And he threw his old picture away. And when he lay out alone, looking at the sky, it was big and blue and all of everything. But he wasn't anymore. He was square inside and brown. And his hands were stiff. And he was like everyone else. And the things inside him that needed saying didn't need it anymore. He'd stopped pushing. It was crushed, stiff. He was just like everyone else. So we're talking about the yearning to be touched. This one was written by a 13-year-old girl. She said, "There are certain beautiful people in my life that I love so very much, but the words just cannot form. They're there in my mind, in my spirit, they're in my soul and in my being. You see, if I told them, they would think I was strange. If I told everybody I was lonely, they may shrug it off, not wanting to think about it. If I explained to them that I really did love them, but my world that I live in, inside myself, means so much to me, and I'm so afraid of being hurt, and most of all, how very afraid I am of being left completely alone, never to feel love, never to give love. For you see, every time I have given love, I've received loneliness in return, and it hurt. And I'm so damn tired and lonely and confused and not being accepted as real. So if I told you that I loved you, would you laugh? If I told you that I would like to hold your hand and walk beside you, would you say no? Because I'd like to feel loved. I'd like to have some company, if it's not too much to ask." Thelonious Monk, Round Midnight, in the background. Ah, Monk. So alone. So untouched. You know, I remember Thelonious Monk when I was younger. He was untouchable. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. We do want to take your calls today. The telephone number here is 212-209-2900. We want to take your calls and talk about you and touch and your sense of touched and being touched. And we want to take your calls about how you felt as a child. How did you feel? How did you feel this idea? I mean, what Jean Liedlof talks about, worthy and welcome. Were you worthy and welcome every time you saw your family, every time you saw someone in your family? Did they give you that look, worthy and welcome? Right? Hey, look who's here, somebody valuable. You know, oh, nice to see you. I work in a wonderful place. Every time I walk in, I feel worthy and welcome, and every time the people who work here walk by, they feel worthy and welcome from me. You know, I see people passing by, I welcome them because I feel that way towards them. But, you know, it's odd. Sometimes people shy away. Sometimes they watch me welcoming them and just saying hi. And they kind of run away. Oops, you know, he's a legend. That's what someone called me today. I can't talk to a legend. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take one of your calls. You're on the air. This is Armand DeMille. Hi there.
Oh, hi, Armand. I did enjoy listening to, what was the lady's name?
Jean Liedlof, L-I-E-D-L-O-F-F.
One thing I just want to comment on is that I think now there is some study that shows that our chemistry, or let's put it this way, our thoughts are transmitted to the other person. Like, I'm talking about if you see somebody that you're kind of averse to or somebody you really care about, the chemistry of the body picks that up. And I think in terms of feeling towards somebody, like you want to hold them or you want to push them away, just the thought can communicate that, being in their, you know, presence.
Well, now, would you? What's your name?
Kathy.
Kathy, would you say that some people have more thoughts of aversion than they do towards attraction? You know, I'm thinking about if you get somebody who's basically scared, paranoid, cautious, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
you know, then they're going to look at everybody and their chemistry is going to say, stay away.
Yes.
And then there are other people who are very, very needy, and they're going to look at everybody and they're going to say, yummy, yummy.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So do you think it's very individual, or do you think it's kind of based on your own construction, what you perceive?
Oh, no, I think it's, I think it's very individual, and your own perceptions, maybe your own inside feelings.
How about you? How about you and your feeling about touch? Do you feel like you've been touched enough in your life?
Well, yes. Yes and no. When I was young, I think I was welcomed, you know, in terms of my family and things like in terms of my parents, even though we had they had a lot of children. So,
well, it's very difficult when you have a lot of children.
Yeah, it is, except they did really. My mother was a full-time housewife, you know.
So how many kids were there?
Seven.
Seven kids. So your mom would pick one up and put the other one down and pick another one up and put the other one down and put him in each other's arms.
And there was also the children helping, you know,
sure.
also. So there was that.
So did you find yourself welcoming, or did you find yourself reluctant to be close to people as you got older?
Well, I both. because things changed as I got older. And my father was very good with children until around the age of like 10 or 11, 12. His own father had died when he was 10. So I imagine that was a big factor in him not knowing how to relate to children anymore, sort of.
So when you became 10 years old,
uh-huh.
your father kind of put you aside.
Yeah.
He didn't want to have anything to do with you.
Right. I mean, me and the other
you
children
and the
as
other
we
kids
got there.
Too. But, you know, it's kind of a thing. It would make a young woman, as she's getting older, she gets to be 10, daddy doesn't want to have anything to do with her anymore. I can't imagine what would encourage her to want to continue growing up being a woman. You know? You know, it would be like if I were that kind of person, I'd say, hey, I want to be little for the rest of my life.
Yeah, I guess so. That's you know what? I don't think that really happened to me, but I think it did happen to a couple of my sisters.
A couple of your sisters.
Yeah. Some of us went the other way to be the parent, and maybe some went to be the child.
So as a parent, how do you feel towards your children? How do you feel? Do you feel that you're really close, or do you think you're afraid to get close to them?
No, I feel very close to my children. And they're older now. I mean, 26 and 22, but I did want to have children, and I was very affectionate with them, and still am when we can be. So, now when they're here.
You missed them a lot, Kathy?
Sometimes.
Well, thank you very much for calling in. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. 212-209-2900, Tender Souls. We're talking about being touched, you know. We're talking about contact with people, you know, feeling close to people. Gene Liedloff, author of The Continuum Project, basically says, Continuum Concept, I'm sorry, basically says over and over again, she says, listen, you know, they knew something down in the Amazon there before they started clearing the trees away with the Yucatán Indians and the Samina's Indians. I think those two names, Samina's, I know for sure. And they said, you know, she said, this is, they cherish their children. They don't even cherish their children. It's just natural. They hold their children. They don't put their children down. The child rides on your hip. You don't leave the child behind because a boa constrictor can easily come along and pick it up and say, gulp. You know, so what you do is you protect your child by keeping your child actively with you at all times. As a result of that, what she said is that there was significant amount of less stress, there was less stress everywhere you went. People were more relaxed. People were happier, and there was a lot more laughter. Well, I certainly could see it. You know, I think I'm going to buy a condo in the Amazon. 212-209-29. I'm just kidding, of course. 212-209-2900, but I really would like to be among that. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Armand?
Yes.
Hi. I'm glad you're there.
Thank you. Thank you. Could you talk just a little louder?
Yes, I will. Is this better?
That's much better.
Wait,
what's your name?
I cupped my hand around the phone.
What's your name?
My name is Anne.
Anne, hi there.
You really, what you're talking about today really, really is timely for me because I've been dealing with this all of a sudden. You mind if I blabber on?
Oh, please go ahead. It's not blabber.
I realize
you
that
are worthy and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. When I was the second child in a middle-class family, and when I was 6 months old, I was just not wanted to the point where I was sent to live with my grandparents. They didn't want me. They sent me to live with a friend of my mother's who had another six-month-old child, and she couldn't deal with me. And they actually went and looked at orphanages to take me in. And that has just affected me so much. Not, I knew that there was always something wrong, but it wasn't until later when I realized what had happened. You know, what I was so unwelcome. They never looked me in the eye. They never held me or touched me. And all my life, I'm attractive, intelligent, talented, all those good things. And people always say, why isn't a girl like you married? And yet, it never happened. I never married, never had children. And it's such a terrible loss. At this point in my life, I'm 61. I've fallen desperately in love with a man who conveniently is from another country and lives half a world away, but I'm going to be seeing him in August, and I am terrified about seeing him because I realize that I lack so much. This is the terror of separation and the realization that you were talking about how someone has to go through the primeval motions of being looked in the eye and of being touched, all of that I never had, and I know, I can't say I know, but I just feel as though this is going to be incredibly difficult for me to see this man and to try to start some sort of a life at my age, and I know it's hopeless, but perhaps you can just say something to think about anyway.
Well, you know, I don't think it's hopeless, Anne. I think that there's plenty of hope in there. I think 61's a young enough age to be able to start it going. But there is something about it. There is something about the rage that you carry. You are furious, and I know you don't feel it, because what you did was you were absolutely enraged by the indecency of the way you were treated. And this rage you've learned to swallow.
Did I mention the sexual abuse? No.
No, I didn't mention it, but that could even go further with it, of course.
Yeah.
And all of this rage, all of this is built up inside of you that you basically stayed away. And I say that there's plenty of opportunity to work on that. It takes nothing. It takes a very short, I don't know if you've been in therapy.
For years, since 1975.
A real course of something that is dynamic therapy that goes directly for that outrage would be fantastic, you know? And if it hasn't touched it, then you haven't done the dynamic stuff enough, even though you've done a tremendous amount of work. And it sounds to me like, you know, the party's about to begin.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah, it does sound like the
problem. Do you have any helpful hints for someone who I realize that I'm very needy, very frightened, and I tend to take a motherly approach with this man as a defense, I suppose, against being the woman I would love to be?
Well, you know, it doesn't happen just one way. If you take a motherly approach, it's because he is welcoming the motherly approach.
Really?
You see, it has to work both ways, because if he weren't welcoming it, he would be doing it differently. You know, but you might hold back a little on your nurturing.
Oh, yes. I think we actually talked about that, and I think it makes him uncomfortable. And I don't want to do it because I've ruined a few relationships.
By being overly nurturing?
Yeah, well, yeah, by being the mother I never was. And then I become mommy to the baby, and it's no fun at all.
Yeah, so it does seem like you have your own cautions and your own caveats and your own things to keep an eye on, you know? And so I guess you're not going to cook dinner too much.
Well, I might cook dinner, but I'm not going to call in my little baby cans or something. But here's a question. Is there a school of therapy that is of the dynamic quality? I went into a school.
Yes, I think there's a thing called the intense feeling process of psychotherapy, and it's a form of Gestalt therapy that I certainly recommend.
And would you please say it again, because I'm going to write it down.
Intense, you know, you can actually find it on my website.
Oh,
if you look on the website, it's defined in there. It's described in there. ThePositiveMind.com.
Okay, and it's the intense something or other, and I'll find it.
Yeah, you'll find it.
Okay, great. Thank you, Armin.
Thank you for calling in, Ann.
Bye.
Thank you for being there, Ann. Thank you for being there, all of you people. Tomorrow, we're going to continue somewhat with this issue of contact. And Roberta Atti will be back with us. Just heard from her. She's back from Italy. So, my friends, if you wanted to get a listen to this again or direct somebody to hear today's program, they could go to thepositivemind.com. You can listen to it. You could download it. You could actually email it to somebody if you think that they would benefit from hearing by it, as you can with almost all of the WBAI programs when the webcast is working. I will be back with you tomorrow at 1. So I played you the old music. Now I'm going to play you the new one. Back with you tomorrow at 1, my friends.